Good afternoon. I would like to beg your indulgence and speak in English. Can everyone understand me? Good. what I would like to do is thank you, first of all, the University of Konstanz, for bringing me here from Afghanistan. I would have come for any reason. As I was telling Professor Scheibel, last evening, I have taken four hot showers in the last day, and I intend to take several more before I go back. Afghanistan is an interesting place. I recommend it to all of you for a tourist spot. It is a very interesting environment for both the theoretical and the practical, and I am a practitioner. What I'd like to do this evening in the next 35 or 40 minutes is talk to you about three things. First of all, the concept of the nature of accountability, and I've added to that prevention as a result of what I have learned here today listening to my colleagues. And I would like to talk in context to Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Rwanda. And then a little bit about Afghanistan, but because I am currently employed by the United States Department of State working in Afghanistan, I will be, if you will appreciate, a bit diplomatic about any answers or comments I make. Also, I would like, if possible, to, I wrote a few things down, and I'm a trial lawyer, so I usually don't read speeches, but I will do this one for the translators, and also to make certain that I get everything that I wanted to say to you. I'll talk openly about Bosnia and Rwanda, and then at the end I'll take questions. So if you would please think about good questions that you can ask, so I won't feel embarrassed at the end if you have none. First of all, a disclaimer. I am not an academic, as you have heard many scholars here. I am not a scholar, nor even a well-studied philosopher in my chosen profession of the law. My formal training is that of an American lawyer, and my career has been in the criminal law, 26 years. I'm a prosecutor, a practitioner of the law in its most practical and basic of all disciplines. I proudly admit to having engaged in this craft over the course of the last several decades in numerous countries on four continents. Yet I am ashamed, as you note, that I am still only speaking my native language of English, and not even that very well yet. But I have a little bit of Bosnian, and I have a little bit of Afghanistan Dari, the language. So if any of you would like to chat afterwards, we can. During the years, I cannot speak Kenya Rwandan, by the way. During the years of my professional practice, I have seen up close the harm that humans can do to the weak and the defenseless, if they are so inclined by greed or hatred or jealousy. Professionally, I have routinely engrossed myself in the minutiae of that horror, from digging in mass graves to drawing out the evidence of tormented and ruined lives from the mouths of the still living. I have helped to bury their dead. I've spent days in graciously respectful discussions with mass murderers in hopes of gaining their testimony against others of their kind. I have energetically built courtrooms and prisons to convict and confine them, so I cannot claim to be objective or detached or even scholarly. My perspective is a peculiar one. I am an admirer of the law and the positive power that it can bring to bear on the conduct of human beings when it is administered justly and with compassion, yet I'm not naive about its fallibility. Laws can be perverted, and justice can be abused. I have seen the results of that abuse firsthand. Lawyers and prosecutors and judges can be corrupted and misled. Courts can be intimidated. Malicious political interests can distort the impartiality of judicial integrity. Our formal justice mechanisms have not yet perfected the science of determining the truth. They are also costly, slow, and inefficient. Practitioners of justice are still human and susceptible to bias and prejudice. Flawed as they are, however, our justice systems are far more appropriate alternative to violence in resolving our conflicts. The commitment to be ruled by law carries a civilization closer to perfection, even if the execution of that commitment falls short. The courage of a people is measured in the quality of their laws and the institutions they build to enforce it. I abhor violence in all its forms, yet I am not a pacifist. Justified force is the shield of diversity and culture. It is a sword when used to protect the innocent and the weak, as you have seen on this dais today. It is a necessary tool of free people in a world that is not yet entirely civilized. As abhorrent as it is sometimes necessary to protect and defend a cherished virtue or shared value. It brings to me great pride to live in a world that has come to an agreement on the most basic of these values. The most cherished virtue upon which we agree is that all humankind is entitled by their birth to equality. The nations of this earth spoke with one voice, their dedication to human dignity and universal equality over the course of the last century. However, Carlton Payne, one of your students at Konstanz, when I was speaking to him over a cigarette a little while ago, indicated to me that these rights and even the definition of equality are constantly being reevaluated. On the flight here from Afghanistan, I read some of the papers from the Gulf states on the issue of whether or not our international human rights are indeed Western European and North American post-colonial values that have no utility in the Islamic world. Editorials like that bring us, I think, to focus even more intensely on the debates and the discussions on what we do share. But I think it is clear that practitioners like me are currently in courts like the ICC, International Criminal Court, the ICTY, the ICTR, the Sierra Leone Tribunal, and now the Phnom Penh Special Court, are applying that law. And so if we have questions in respect to what those values are, then we need to debate them openly. However, it shames me constantly that we, both people and nations, fail to protect the weak and the oppressed with our commitment to defend them. Darfur, Rwanda, Congo, East Timor, Cambodia, West Africa, Central America, Zimbabwe, Bosnia, it goes on, Afghanistan. As a prosecutor, a lawyer, and an American, I know the power we have to defend and protect if we wish to use it. I'm ashamed that we fail to do so time and time and time again. It is from this humble perspective that I offer the defense of accountability and advocacy for the duty to protect. In my view, it is on these two concepts that our honor as humans, our dignity as virtuous beings, and our claim to be civilized rests. Any government works because the people that live under it trust that its institutions will function in a predictable manner. Regardless of how oppressive, dictatorial, authoritarian, or benevolent a regime might be, its people can adopt if they know what to expect of their leaders. Democracies work because the people believe that the government works, in the final analysis, for them collectively. Periodically, the people are asked and they are allowed to reinforce the order of government as servants of them, the people. Their leaders know that they must respond to the will of the people, for someday those leaders will be judged by them. Power then is only temporary in your country and mine, and held in trust by the government for the people. Such systems breed arrogance in the character of the citizenry. That arrogance manifests itself in individual initiative and open expression and cultural diversity. And we enjoy that in our societies, and they don't exist in many others. In civil war, the institutions of government turn on the people, or at least some of the people, those who have exercised individual initiative or open expression or are culturally diverse. The organs of power that control the justifiable use of violence that any government or sovereign or community of nations has a right to use, that are ordinarily designed to defend and protect the people, is perverted to harm them, or at least some of them. The institutions act in deviant ways, and the fabric of culture woven together are shredded. The trust is lost in the trauma of random violence and murder. As was said of Bosnia, it is like the inmates have taken over the asylum. In many cases, the inmates are former neighbors, or parish priests, or brothers, or teachers, or policemen. When a society collapses in chaos and civil war, its neighbors usually stand in shocked silence and watch from a distance, as we did in Bosnia, the Community of Nations. True, diplomats and politicians issue warnings and pronouncements, but little is done to stop the brutality and destruction. It is because of the profound respect nations have for each other's sovereignty. A concept that dates back to the era of kings and princes who owned their own people and all the land upon which they lived. A monarch had the right, after all, to do with his possessions what he wishes. Unless, of course, advantage could be taken by other nations of the chaos to carve out a little of that country for annexation as the king was slaughtering his people. The Holocaust of the first half of the 20th century taught us that such indulgence or respect for sovereignty was wrong. We have said never again shall such a thing happen. Never again shall we sit idly by and fail to protect the victims as people because they are citizens of another country. Our community of nations has come together, as I said with qualification, time and again, to agree that there are certain things, rights, that all human beings have, irrespective of the passport they carry. We as nations, united by our basic values, have recognized the virtue of universal equality, regardless of what we debate that meaning to be. We share the repudiation of mass murder, even though we do not share the concept of capital punishment. We have power to act on our convictions individually, perhaps, with our own military, or certainly collectively as a community of nations. We have the institutions to facilitate our collective use of force and the forum to decide whether that the use of that force is justified or not. We even have the judicial institutions to enforce the laws we have recognized as international and humane once the criminals are stopped from the killing and brought to justice. Our language reflects our commitment when we call such atrocities crimes against humanity. That's us. We even have the concept of complementarity now with the International Criminal Court to explain how international courts can work to remove those most responsible and share jurisdiction and evidence with rejuvenated post-conflict national courts to hold accountable foot soldiers of genocide as well. As rape is not a crime of passion, but one of power and dominance, so also is genocide not a crime of political ideology, but one of greed and exploitation. As the crime of murder has no limit, to borrow the prosecutor during the life of the murderer, so too must the mass murderer live out his or her life in fear of accountability for the lives that he or she has destroyed. We now have the commitment and the tools to make justice real for crimes that challenge the imagination by their magnitude and vulgarity. It is said war crimes prosecutions in post-conflict countries merely perpetuate the conflict, for the people of those countries. Let me suggest that when the international community fails to timely act to stop or prevent the atrocities and restore peace, the people of that country lose trust in the international community and the values that we hold. When the killing stops with a diplomatically negotiated peace, as it has so often, brokered by the international community with the perpetrators of the chaos and mass violence, the people of that country do not regain their trust. They are merely relieved, but still hopeful. When the international community then arrives in post-conflict countries with visions of creating a democratic and stable nation, as we define those, from the ashes of the conflict, the people are hopeful still. But when the international community installs those same butchers into the positions of power in the new government and calls for reconciliation between the warring sides, or truth and reconciliation, the people lose their faith and their trust and their hope. When asked by the international experts whether they want peace or justice, they lie. For them, there is no reason to believe in or be truthful to an international community who says it holds dear the virtues of peace and justice, and then offers them one or the other. They want both. We owe them both. Why? Because we have said that is what we believe in, and we should not be liars, nor make them into ones either. Nation building is not the rebuilding of a post-conflict culture in our own image. It is the reestablishment of the rule of law in a manner that the people within that culture understand and respect. The values of the Western democracies are relevant, but not dispositive. Humility among nation builders is a virtue rarely seen. When reestablishing the rule of law, of a rational law, we must respect the culture of the people who must live under it, and the long road that our own democracies in the last centuries have traveled. The concept of civil wars is an interesting one, and as I said, I would like to address two examples. The first is Bosnia, and the second one is Rwanda. First of all, Bosnia, as we all know, was a war that could have been stopped, and some say even prevented. Bosnia was shown to us on the nightly news, CNN, BBC, Sky News, Euronews, every day. And the great journalists who made their careers covering the slaughter in Bosnia-Herzegovina are anxious to tell you how many risks they took to get those stories to tell us. An interpreter I had in the Netherlands had left Sarajevo one night after forging her passport in the basement of some friend's house and getting on Maybe Airlines out of the airport in Sarajevo. She still has the passport and it's stamped Maybe Airlines because maybe it would fly and maybe it wouldn't. And she left for whatever country that that particular plane flew to. She left after a particular ugly mortaring attack in Sarajevo, where her job at the hospital of an administrator required her to come down and collect the limbs of the severed limbs of the bodies that had been brought in. And by the end of a long and harrowing day, she was carrying a number of those severed limbs and holding them up, saying, "I have a little girl's right hand with a white glove. Does anyone have the match?" This woman was 27 years of age and pregnant. She left with her husband that night. She said to me, "I like you Americans. You're very generous and kind people, and you mean well. But I don't trust you." She is, by the way, in the Netherlands as a citizen now. And I said, why do you say that? She said, because every day we expected you to come and stop the slaughter, because we could see your jets, we could see your UN tanks, and we had a clear understanding that you were seeing what we saw because your journalists were taking pictures of it every day. And every morning we woke up and said, this will be the day that you will come and stop it, because you speak of the values of our lives, and you never did. So we like you a great deal, but we don't really trust you. Dayton was the marriage of three evils. And if we look at the history of Dayton, it was the bringing together of the organizers of the carnage in Bosnia. Today, 12 years after, almost 13 years after Dayton, what do we have in Bosnia? We have those same factions in charge of a divided country, and we still have a long list of unresolved accountability for crimes committed there. Dayton's principle was that we would bring the warring parties together and they would stop the war, because after all, they were the only ones who could, because they were the ones who were conducting it. And also, by the way, trading substantially on contraband back and forth across the front lines. One side would trade bullets to the other side for food and vice versa. And the next morning, the bullets would fly over and the food would be in the stomachs of the soldiers of the other side firing back. Those same criminals are in charge of the economy of Bosnia today. And we are surprised that organized crime is a serious problem in the Balkans. Yet, accountability for their crimes committed then and their accountability for crimes committed now are in some fashion anti-Dayton, according to Patty Ashdown, the High Representative for Bosnia-Herzegovina, because, after all, we need peace, and justice can come later. We created a UN tribunal in the Netherlands to take care of crimes against humanity committed in the Balkans, didn't we? And in fact, shortly after Dayton was signed, an addendum was signed in Rome that said no prosecutor in Bosnia would be allowed to arrest a suspect for crimes against humanity or war crimes or genocide unless the chief prosecutor, then Louise Arbour, had the opportunity to review the basis for the indictment for under international standards of sufficiency. So therefore, no prosecutions were allowed because they were anti-Dayton. They called that rules of the road. The reason they called it that is because the peacekeepers in Bosnia were upset that some of the soldiers and politicians they were negotiating with were being arrested on the roads because the borders were so uncertain between Srpska and Bosnia, between the factions in the Dayton designed peace. So therefore, we said to the people of Bosnia, peace, not justice. And leave it to the UN, we'll do it in The Hague. Well, Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, you all know those names. You all know those names because those names are the names of those most responsible for the actual carnage on the ground. And their lieutenants have been prosecuted in The Hague, many of them, and many of them have not. There's a war crimes court in Bosnia now. It was established in 2005, but it was not established by the international community to provide justice to Bosnia. It was established in large measure on the initiative of the European Union and the United States in order to give an explanation for why we were not going to spend $130 million a year on the UN ICTY in perpetuity. It was an exit strategy from international justice. That court has been a great success. But I was just reading before I came in a news announcement that they are beginning to suffer from a lack of resources, and victims are not being treated very well in the court. The idea of our obligation to the people of Bosnia and that woman, my translator, would never happen in our communities, in your, in Konstanz or in New Hampshire in the United States. We would never tolerate it. We would never suggest that those people who had committed crimes were too difficult for us to bring to justice or too expensive or it was taking too long. Radovan Stanković, the first of a historical figure, Radovan Stanković ran a rape camp in Foča during the war, where he took Bosniak women and he sold them to his soldiers and policemen within the Bosnian Serb army. Radovan Stanković was arrested as a war criminal under an international warrant on the border between Bosnia and Serbia. He was taken to The Hague some 4 or 5 years ago, indicted, prosecuted, and sat waiting for trial. He was the first individual in history to be the subject of complementarity, the relationship between an international court and a national court built on international standards, the Court of Bosnia-Herzegovina, War Crimes Chamber. Radovan Stanković was transferred back by jet to Bosnia, indicted, reformed indictment from the tribunal, and then was tried, convicted, and sentenced. The international community had the design, the permits, the law, everything necessary to build a national prison to hold war criminals and others, organized crime figures on a national level in Bosnia. But we found it too expensive. The international community, $14 million, was too expensive to build such a prison because, after all, there were still prisons in Republic Srpska and in the Federation, the two parts of Bosnia that were created by Dayton. So Radovan Stanković, after the expenditure of about 20 million euros of international money, your taxes and mine, for the arrest, extradition, prosecution, and retransfer back to Bosnia, re-indictment, prosecution, and sentencing, was shipped to a little prison in Foča, the same place where he had lived and functioned and sold the women of his community to his friends. And guess what? The prison in Foča was run by his friends. And guess what? Radovan Stanković, anybody want to guess? Lasted in custody a few months and miraculously escaped and is now nowhere to be found. If you were a citizen of Foča today, or a refugee, as you saw earlier, suffering from the trauma of that event, and you relied on justice and realized that the man who had caused you so much pain and trauma was now free again because the international community thought it too expensive to build a prison to hold you, even though it was spending $125, $130 million a year for its tribunal in The Hague, would you be trustful? I think not. Rwanda. Rwanda is a very significant failure to prevent and to fully punish. Acts of genocide are occurring in Rwanda. As we all know, the Genocide Convention, one of our shared values, produced an obligation on the part of the international community to stop genocide when it was occurring. Yet the United States government said, when asked by a Reuters reporter, is genocide occurring in Rwanda? The response was, well, acts of genocide are occurring in Rwanda. People like me, said the President of the United States, We're sitting in offices around the world, not fully aware of the speed with which you were being engulfed. That was his apology to the Rwandan people in 1997 when he came to Kigali and left the engines of his Air Force One still running on the tarmac as he ran into the airport to apologize for failure to prevent. No one in Rwanda believed him. And the reason they didn't believe him is because of a man by the name of Marcel Savad and many others like him. Marcel worked with me in the Rwanda tribunal, and he was with UNAMIR during the genocide. And when the United Nations Security Council agreed to withdraw its peacekeepers from Rwanda in the middle of the genocide because of negotiations between the great powers, my country and yours, they agreed to let the French invade Rwanda and engage in a Operation Turquoise, in which they pacified the border between Rwanda and Congo, and through which the genocidaire fled into Congo and away from justice, with most of the assets of the Rwandan government. Marcel Savad was an administrator in the UN, and one of his greatest achievements was the evacuation of half of the troops, the peacekeeping troops of UNAMIR, United Nations mission in Rwanda, to Kenya when that decision was made. Not only did we not know the speed, but we were anxious to get out of its way. Victor's justice, Rwanda. I will conclude on this. Today we have an administration in Kigali made up of a man who was elected with 95% of the vote in its first constitutional election. He is a member of a minority party of 15%, roughly, of the population and the vast majority of the military. His troops have been in eastern Congo for the last 6-7 years, where close to 3 million people have died. He and the Ugandan forces and others have been waging war that is outside the scope of reporters, cameras, and interviews. Yet, the RPF, the government of Rwanda today, has never been indicted for any crimes committed during the civil war in Rwanda. And they have conducted Gacaca, which is a traditional justice process, which has refused to accept any allegations against the RPF. Yet half of the financial support for Rwanda today comes from the international community. A good half of it comes from Great Britain alone. We also have the Rwandan government providing security troops for the peacekeeping in Sudan now. I would assume the same troops that have been in Congo for the last number of years. The fact is that the Arusha Accords that were signed in April of 1994 were sufficient basis for us to go in as an international community and enforce them, stop the genocide, and provide justice as well as peace. And we didn't do so. And as a consequence, the people of Rwanda in their vote of 95% were doing so because they believed that was their best option. Today, if you are a European, you can travel all over Rwanda, and it's quite charming. If you're Rwandese, you cannot, without going through numerous roadblocks and checkpoints that govern the transit of Rwandese throughout the country. People want peace and justice. We owe them both. My only comment about Afghanistan is, have we learned our lesson? Thank you very much.